This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 42nd episode. For this month's edition of the podcast, we return to the JCENM to tackle a clinical trial that looks at the beneficial effects of adding a GLP-1 receptor agonist to exercise in individuals with type 2 diabetes. Semaglutide, as is used here, and other GLP-1s are quite the hot topic today, and we thought it would be particularly important to learn more about the potential benefits of these medications. Unusually for us, this investigation is a clinical trial, so we will be sure to review that study design and how it contrasts to observational studies. As a brief reminder, I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop and work at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center as a general endocrinologist and medical director. Returning today to our virtual recording studio is this month's regular contributor, Steve Whitland. He works at the University of Rochester as a general endocrinologist and clinical director. He focuses his clinical work on diabetes in addition to conducting research in diabetes, diabetes technology, and innovations in diabetes treatment. For this episode of the podcast, we excitedly welcome in Zinchi Liu as our guest expert. He comes to us from the University of Virginia, where he is the past chief for the Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism. His lab work centers on understanding insulin action, ranging from rodent models to clinical trials in humans. One of those current clinical trials is looking at the effects of exercise and GLP-1 receptor agonists on insulin action, which explains why we thought that he would be a great guest for today. As you can readily see, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joins me today to help us understand this paper. As is also always the case, everything we say will be our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. For this episode of the podcast, we review effects of aerobic training in semaglutide treatment on pancreatic beta cell secretory function in patients with type 2 diabetes. Arthur Ingerson served as the first author for this paper, which comes to us from the University of Copenhagen and is forthcoming in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Now I will hand the discussion off to Steve. He will highlight the important points made by the authors in their introduction. He will also lead several discussions on these points and get Zinchi to give us key background information. Steve?
Hi, Chase. So the introduction mentions that the hallmarks of type 2 diabetes are inadequate beta cell function and insulin resistance. We were going to ask Zinchi to give an overview of the pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes. Zinchi?
Thank you, Chase and Steve. As we all know, type 2 diabetes is the most prevalent metabolic disorder, affecting approximately 11% of the U.S. population. That means close to 40 million people are affected in the United States. Overnutrition, which results from an imbalance between energy intake and energy expenditure, plus genetic predisposition are two most important causal factors. The pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes actually is very complex, and multiple abnormalities are associated with the type 2 diabetes pathogenesis. As you have mentioned, the hallmarks of type 2 diabetes are insulin resistance and inadequate beta cell function. Insulin resistance can occur in multiple organs and tissues, including skeletal muscle, adipose tissue, liver, central nervous system, and the cardiovascular system. As each organ or tissue has different functions, the outcomes of insulin resistance in each organ and tissue also differ. On the other hand, inadequate beta cell function is the result of reduced beta cell mass, decreased incretin effect, and reduced beta cell response to glucose. This combination of insulin resistance and inadequate beta cell function leads to decreased skeletal muscle glucose uptake, increased hepatic glucose production, and increased lipolysis. All factors contribute to the development of type 2 diabetes.
Thank you very much. So they note in the introduction that aerobic training improves insulin-mediated glucose uptake and glycemic control, but this actually depends on the prevailing beta cell function. What defines the prevailing beta cell function, and what does this mean for us?
So I have to go back one step, because the effect of exercise on glycemia can be divided into acute and training associated. Acute exercise per se induces a rapid increase in the rate of glucose uptake in the contracting muscle by recruiting glucose transporter 4 to cell membrane. This effect is actually relatively short-lived, returning to baseline in approximately 30 to 40 minutes. Acute exercise, particularly strenuous exercise, also increases hepatic glucose production due to a simultaneous increase in epinephrine, and also can inhibit insulin secretion. That means acute exercise can either decrease or increase blood glucose. On the other hand, aerobic exercise training improves whole body, particularly skeletal muscle responses to insulin. The overall mechanisms are not well understood. We and other investigators have shown that aerobic exercise training improves insulin-mediated muscle microvascular perfusion. This action leads to an increased endothelial exchange surface area within the skeletal muscle, and thus increased delivery of oxygen, nutrients, and insulin into muscle interstitium. So overall, the acute effect of exercise is insulin independent, but the training effect of exercise depends on prevailing beta cell function or the ambient insulin.
So they note that few studies have investigated the effects of exercise interventions with an anti-diabetic medication. And so one cannot assume that two effective treatments will necessarily complement each other just because they're effective independently. So I think that, just to kick this off, the question is the complementary versus additive versus synergistic, because that's going to come up during the paper, and the differences between those two. What do you think, Senshi?
Steve, you are absolutely right. It is important to study the effects of exercise training in combination with anti-diabetic medications. Indeed, it's actually not surprising that two effective treatments for whatever disease, including diabetes, cannot be assumed to complement each other just because they work differently. You know, logically, we would think so, but many times things may come at us as a surprise. For example, exercise and metformin have both been very effective in diabetes prevention and glycemic control. But multiple studies have suggested there is an interfering effect of metformin on the insulin sensitizing and the cardiorespiratory fitness improvements induced by exercise training. So this is one of the hot topics, and there are a lot of ongoing study to looking at both intervention, why they are so effective, but also, you know, potential there's some interference.
And I really like that the authors called this out, because I think clinically, I certainly do this. When we don't have data on combinations of whether it's multiple medicines or exercise plus something else, I think our instinct is often just to add it. Well, if this medicine drops an A1C about 1 point and this one does about 1.5, if I do both of them, it's probably going to be 2.5. I love that the authors point out you can't assume that. Maybe it's more if they've got some sort of a synergistic effect. Maybe it is truly additive. It's just one plus the other. Actually, maybe it's a little bit less. I think we actually see that quite a bit with medications and what data that we have. So I love that the authors point this out, and that we're actually trying to get some data to help us understand how these two interventions, one a medicine and one a lifestyle intervention, do work together.
Yeah. Also, when you're looking at two different studies and combining medications, the starting point of the glucose control is going to affect the outcome in terms of lowering of hemoglobin A1C.
Precisely.
So most studies with exercise training have focused mainly on insulin sensitivity, and GLP-1 receptor agonist studies have additionally focused on weight loss. However, there are not that many studies that focus on the effect of exercise and GLP-1 on beta cell function. So the hypothesis of this paper is that aerobic exercise training, and now I'm quoting, with and without concurrent steady state semaglutide treatment, their hypothesis is that it would improve insulin secretory capacity in patients with type 2 diabetes with, and I quote, moderately preserved beta cell function. And again, we alluded to this before, Tenshi. It's kind of hard to define what moderately preserved beta cell function means in absolute terms.
You're right. There are not a whole lot of study looking at the effect of extra training and semaglutide or GLP-1 receptor agonist on insulin secretion capacity in people with diabetes. Actually, the hypothesis from the authors actually was based on a study, earlier study, by the senior author of this paper, which was published in 2004 in American Journal of Physiology, Endocrinology, and Metabolism. And in that paper, the authors actually found out that in people with type 2 diabetes, but moderately preserved beta cell function, excess training actually improves pancreatic response or added response to glucose. But people with low beta cell reserve did not. And the cutoff they used actually was a C-peptide response to glucagon injection. So the low, I think it was like 0.3 and above. So the people with moderate reserve was around a response of 1.1 nanomolar, but the low response was around 0.3 nanomolar.
I would chime in on the hypothesis, and I appreciate Zainchi giving some background on that. I was maybe a little surprised exactly how it was stated, and I think we've already gathered from the name and then the introduction already, is we're really trying to understand the effects of semaglutide on top of exercise. The way the hypothesis is stated, it's saying that it's looking at whether aerobic exercise training with and without concurrent steady state semaglutide affects insulin secretory capacity. So the way it's phrased, it's almost as if they're saying we're looking for the effects of exercise regardless of semaglutide use. So maybe a little bit odd. I think what they're really trying to figure out is, does semaglutide have an effect? So fortunately, I don't think it makes a big difference in the results that they come to, but it surprised me a little bit given what they are trying to demonstrate here.
So I think we're going to move on to the methods.
Yeah, I'll take things over at this point and walk through the methods. And as we usually do, we'll think about the study design in general. I alluded to this in the introduction, but most of the studies that we look at on this podcast are observational studies. And we have to wrestle with a bunch of unique features that show up in that study design. This is a form of a clinical trial. And so I think many of us are familiar with that. That's one of the main study designs we look at, particularly around medication effects. But we'll think about it since we don't do that a lot for this podcast. So the way a clinical trial, the big difference with that from an observational study is that in clinical trials, the trial itself is responsible for some form of intervention and assigning it. And we'll talk about how that gets assigned. But in observational studies, to contrast that, there's something else that's deciding whether a patient is getting treated or whether they've been exposed to something else. It's a clinician that's deciding that they get exposed to something in an environment because of where they live. It's not a part of the trial. It's something else that has happened otherwise, and we're attempting to study the effects. In clinical trials, there's much more intentionality about that. There are two big parts of clinical trials, but they don't always go with it. And I think we often assume that it's a part of it, but it's important to call those out as distinct and to make sure that it's a part of a clinical trial. And in this situation, one of them is and one of them isn't. The first one is randomization. And the way that we think about randomization is what it's hoping to accomplish. And it overcomes one of the issues with observational studies. With observational studies, because something else besides the trial is affecting whether you end up in one group or another, you will have confounders and they will not be balanced. You'll frequently, almost always, have confounders that are more present in one group than another. And then that can then affect your results and you have to account for those. When you randomize, if you do it well and you have enough people in your study, then you are balancing the confounders in your groups. You don't get rid of them. They don't somehow disappear. But if you've done it correctly, there's roughly the same amount of one confounder in one group as the other. And so you can almost think of them as canceling each other out in terms of the effect. So that's what randomization is for. That's why you do it in clinical trials. And that is something that's done here. The second part, something that's often assumed to be in a clinical trial, but you can't because it's not here, is blinding. And the reason that we blind in clinical trials when we can is because it overcomes another issue that shows up in observational trials, and that's treating groups differently because you know that they were exposed or unexposed to an intervention or whatever it is that you're studying. So those are different forms of biases. And you just think of it, a bias, it just, we think about this outside of medical literature, is if you treat one group differently than you treat another group, that's a bias. And that's true in biomedical research, though there's certainly not a sinister component to that. It's something that may be done unintentionally, you may not even be aware of it, but it can affect the results that you're coming up with in your study. And the benefits of that is if you are blinding, meaning you don't know as an investigator or you as a subject do not know which group you are in, you can't be treated differently because you don't know which group you're in. So you treat everybody the same because you don't know the difference. And that's the benefit of blinding. That's not done here. So we're going to think about that and how that may have an impact. But that's just a brief high-level overview of the methodology of clinical trials. Okay, now back to this study in particular. So there are two groups. There is one group that undergoes 12 weeks of aerobic training. There are 15 participants in this group. The other group first undergoes 20 weeks of semaglutide, and give you more details on all this in just a second. But after that 20 weeks of semaglutide, this group then does that 12 weeks of aerobic training with ongoing use of semaglutide. There are 16 participants in this group. One thing that I'll say that I couldn't come up with a great explanation for is the authors mention, actually later on in the results, is that four individuals in this second group, the semaglutide group, were already on semaglutide when they started this study. So I'm not sure if those folks were also randomized and that just happened to work out that way, or if actually the four who came into this study already on it were put into the semaglutide group in a non-randomized way. That was a little bit unclear, but the authors do state that the allocation was random. As far as the inclusion criteria for this study, this included inactive men and women between the ages of 40 and 70 who had a BMI greater than 28. They also had to have a stable weight, so they define that as less than 2 kilogram change in the past 6 months. As has been talked about a little bit already, is you had type 2 diabetes with moderately preserved beta cell function. So we're going to get Zinchu to give us some input on this again. But the way the authors define it here is that after getting that milligram of glucagon IV, you had to have an increase in your plasma C-peptide of at least 0.5 nanomoles. So Zinchu, can you give us a little bit of an overview on that cutoff? Does that make sense as far as what the authors have previously investigated and what they're hoping to understand here?
Actually, that cutoff is adequate. As you know, C-peptide response to glucagon is an excellent test for measuring residual beta cell function in people with either type 1 or type 2 diabetes. And overall, in healthy human adults, in the fasting condition, if we receive a glucagon injection of 1 milligram, plasma concentration of C-peptide tend to increase by approximately 1 nanomolar. But in people with type 2 diabetes or, you know, in type 1, the response would be much less. And the peak response usually occurs within 6 to 10 minutes. That's why they're using 6 minutes. So as I mentioned in the study by the senior author down in 2004, they examined the beta cell response to glucose and the excess training effect on beta cell function. And found out that those people with low reserve did not respond well to cutoff to excess training. And those people had a C-peptide response to glucagon injection of approximately 0.3 nanomolar on average. So that's part of the reason they used a cutoff of 0.5.
Thank you. That is helpful. And exclusion criteria for this study, so history of insulin use or pancreatitis, both of those were exclusion criteria. There were several medical conditions, comorbidities that were considered exclusion criteria for this investigation. More details on the interventions here. So first of all, as far as the exercise goes, the training itself, and this will be something where we get Zinchi's input here in just a second, but the authors described it as using a bicycle ergometer 3 times weekly for 12 weeks. Each of those sessions lasted 45 minutes and had an average heart rate reserve of 75% of the maximum. All right, Zinchi, help us understand that exercise. I think we, at least on the clinical side, we'll tell our folks to exercise, maybe tell them how long to exercise. I'm not sure we get quite this sophisticated. So what exactly are they talking about and what does this mean in terms of exercise effects?
Let's make this a little bit simple. So this actually, the training regimen actually fits the recommendation from the American Diabetes Association quite well, that adults with type 2 diabetes should engage in 150 minutes or more of moderate to vigorous intensity aerobic activity per week, spread over at least 3 days per week, with no more than 2 consecutive days without activity. So roughly, you know, meet the recommendation. And the moderate intensity physical activity usually is defined as those activities that brings our target heart rate to between 64% to 76% of the maximum heart rate. So they use a cutoff of 75 actually falls in that range.
Good. And then the other intervention here is the use of semaglutide, and that's the injection form of that. And as is typically done clinically, there is a gradual dose escalation to at least the 0.5 milligrams weekly. And for most subjects, got all the way up to 1 milligram weekly is the maximum dose that's used here. Finally, as far as the outcomes go, the primary outcome is the change in beta cell secretory function, and that's measured as the area under the curve during a hyperglycemic clamp. There are several secondary outcomes, and why they are changes in glucose tolerance, beta cell sensitivity, glycated hemoglobin, maximal oxygen uptake, and body composition, that final one being measured via DEXA. And there are quite a few exploratory outcomes here. Several of those turn out to be important, and I'm going to defer those until Steve actually walks us through them in the results. So I will turn things back over to Steve at this point, and he will go through, there's quite a bit of data here, so he's going to walk us through that and help us understand that as we go along. Steve?
There is an abundance of data reported in this paper. So I have elected in some instances to try to simplify the data for the sake of clarity. First of all, in terms of exercise, the average workload was increased by 27% in the training group and 18% in the combination group. So there is some difference, and I think this will come back during the discussion. The VO2 max increased by about 380 mLs per O2 per minute in both of the groups. The average workload for the 70% VO2 max in the last minute, the training group was 94 to 123, and the combination group was 84 to 117 watts. You want to comment, Senshi, if these are what you would expect?
Yes, Steve. These results actually are expected, as VO2 max increased similarly in both groups after exercise training. As you know, VO2 max is the maximum amount of oxygen one can use in 1 minute per kilogram of body weight, and is mostly determined by workload, excess workload, which in turn is determined by excess volume and excess intensity. The American College of Sports Medicine actually recommends that the optimal intensity is between 60% and 80% of VO2 max. I think they use the 70% of the VO2 max of the workload, and both groups increased adequately to the training.
Thank you. So in terms of glycemia and body composition, the hemoglobin A1C decreased by 16 millimoles per mole, and henceforth I will have translated this into percent as we use hemoglobin A1C we're familiar with. So that's about 1.5% reduction in the semaglutide group and about 0.5% reduction in the training group and in the combination group. We'll come back to this in the discussion, but it's interesting that there was a greater hemoglobin A1C reduction in the semaglutide group than there was in the combination group. The fasting glucose, the semaglutide group fell by about 3.2 nanomolars, which by my arithmetic is about 57 milligrams per deciliter. The training group fell by about 0.7 nanomoles per mole, nanomolar, and the combination group fell by about half. So again, the effect on fasting glucose was more prominent with semaglutide than it was with the combination group. In terms of weight, the semaglutide group lost about 6.7 kilograms. The training group had no change in weight, and the combination group lost 2.1 kilograms. The body composition, which if anyone's following it in the paper, is in figure two. And I think these are really interesting outcomes. So the lean body mass fell by about 2 kilograms in the semaglutide group. And there was essentially no significant change in the lean body mass in either of the exercise groups. The body fat decreased by about more than 2% in the semaglutide group and about 1.3% in both of the training groups. The fat mass decreased by about 5 kilograms in the semaglutide group and about 2 kilograms in the exercise groups. The visceral fat mass decreased by about 750 grams in the semaglutide group, about 450 in the combined group, and 300 grams in the training group. And it seemed that semaglutide enhanced the training effect on visceral as opposed to total fat mass. My hypothesis would be that perhaps the fat mass change is such a larger value than the visceral change in absolute numbers that it smothers the measurements of the visceral fat and that change. We finally come to the primary endpoint, the hyperglycemic clamp results. The insulin area under the curve, the semaglutide, and again, I'm simplifying here because there's lots of data. The semaglutide enhanced insulin secretion by a ratio of 7.1 in the step one and 12.74 in the step two clamp. The combination further improved the ratio by 1.31 and 1.33 in the two, and training only, the ratio was 1.28 and 1.61. The absolute change in the combination group during the higher, the 30 millimole clamp, was 118 nanomolar. The proinsulin to insulin ratio, which presumably measures the normalization of insulin secretion, decreased in the semaglutide group, the combination group, and the training group, and this suggests an enhanced insulin processing in the beta cells. There are the results of the oral glucose tolerance test that was performed, and here the area under the curve improved in all groups. However, when correcting for the fasting blood sugar at the start of the OGTT, the training groups did not show any significant effect. The beta cell glucose sensitivity, which is the incremental insulin area under the curve versus the incremental glucose, improved with semaglutide by 1.38, but not with the training group. And the area under the curve for the GLP-1 was elevated in the semaglutide groups, and they're hypothesizing in the paper that this was due to cross-reactivity between the semaglutide and the GLP-1 assay. Finally, there were some other parameters, and I'll go over them briefly. They looked at liver function and lipids to simplify this. The highly sensitive CRP was lowered in the combination group, not the others. The ALAT was reduced in all, but mostly in the combination group. And there was an overall decrease in transaminases, lipids, and the combination was associated with a rise in HDL. Inflammatory markers were minimally affected, which I kind of found surprising, with a decrease in IL-6 in the combination group. And they also note that with acute exercise, there was suppressed insulin release, and there was an increase, as expected, in lactate, epinephrine, and IL-6 in all the groups, and norepinephrine increased in both groups, but less in the combination group. Chase?
All right, great work, Steve, going through all that data. So now what we're going to do as we move into the discussion, we're going to look at how the authors put all this together, and then we're going to try to give you some of our thoughts on that along the way. So we'll start with how the authors summarize initially here their findings. So they say, and this is a quote, semaglutide increased insulin secretion by ratios of 7 and 13 from baseline with the two hyperglycemic steps, confirming its highly effective glucose-dependent potentiation of insulin secretion. The authors then go on to try to make sense of this. And this first one, we'll describe here what the authors put as how this may be working. So I want Zinchi to help us understand this some more. So first of all, they say that the insulin secretion improved with training regardless of the use of semaglutide, but was 7 times greater when it was combined with semaglutide. And here's the key thing. The authors say that this suggests a synergistic effect via two different mechanisms, one of those potentially being altered beta cell glucose sensitivity. So Zinchi, help us understand that, particularly how the authors are coming up with that this must be synergistic and that it must be two different mechanisms. So what about these results? You think about this. Why would they come up with that conclusion based on their results?
Well, actually, I'm having a little bit of difficulty in understanding exactly how the data should be interpreted here, because the study design actually makes it very difficult to compare the excess effects between the two groups. Why at the time of study inception, two groups had similar baseline characteristics, The combination group actually received semaglutide treatment for 20 weeks before they started excess training. And the other group actually just, you know, for whatever looks like nothing happened for 20 weeks and then had excess training. So those participants in the combination group lost a significant amount of body weight, and also their glycemic control improved significantly before they started excess training. So in essence, the two groups were not exactly matched at the time of excess initiation. But if you have to look at the data, if you look at the strictly at glucose-stimulated insulin secretion data before and after excess training, the improvements in terms of ratio change were quite comparable between the two groups. So I think, you know, the only conclusion we can definitively draw based on data is that the semaglutide for 20 weeks is more effective than excess training of 12 weeks in improving islet responses to glucose. I'm not sure I can, you know, draw the conclusion of either additive or synergistic effect based on the data here.
Good, that's helpful. And some of the concerns that you've raised, the authors do address later on, or at least acknowledge that it's a difficulty in their study. So we'll come back and we will certainly think about those more. So the next thing that the authors point out is that they point out that all interventions led to an increase in glucose disposal, but that the glucose disposal was not enhanced by increases in insulin with exercise added to semaglutide. So that suggests that the semaglutide alone caused a maximal stimulation. The authors then go on to talk about several different mechanisms. They spend a while here pulling in a bunch of other literature to try to explain what they might be seeing here and how that might be working. So a couple of comments that they make about the effects of exercise. They say that that likely ameliorated glucolipotoxic stress and low-grade inflammation and reduced ectopic triglyceride storages. As far as the weight loss goes, and this is something that, as you mentioned earlier, based on data that's been reported elsewhere, they said that, well, combining training and weight loss does not seem to potentiate insulin release, so that these synergistic effects were probably not just from the weight loss. They do point out, again, from work that's been done elsewhere, is that there is some suggestion that there may be improvements in GLP-1 sensitivity at the level of the beta cell. So that may be explaining some of the results, the effects that are seen here. And one last thing that they point out, the last thing that Steve walked us through in the results, is with norepinephrine. So they said that the lower concentrations in the combined group, that group that that as Zinchi walked us through, did the semaglutide and then added exercise to ongoing semaglutide use, that lower concentration of norepinephrine may be contributing. All right, Steve, comment from you on that.
Yeah, during the acute exercise, there was increased epinephrine and norepinephrine. And I just thought maybe Zenshi could comment on whether this was affecting glucose disposal in the exercise groups.
Well, so what did they look at was actually the response from acute exercise session, not from the exercise training session effect. So probably it's not. And based on their data, I think all those, you know, the glucose disposal will most likely from the insulin secreted from the beta cell secretion of insulin upon stimulation of glucose caused increased glucose disposal, not from the acute effect of epinephrine or norepinephrine here.
Good. So we're going to keep wrestling with some of these issues. First, though, we'll talk about some of the limitations that the authors point out. So one, they do acknowledge that there is no placebo. If you were going to do this as truly a blinded study, you would need to have a placebo in place. So they did not do this as a blinded study. And part of that is they did not have a placebo here. So that's one potential issue and how you can introduce some bias into this investigation. They also point out that there was not a study of the influence of the order of intervention. So they, when you had the two groups, that combined group, it was semaglutide, then exercise. So they didn't look to see if that sequence made a big difference. They also do point out that there's a possible underestimation of the effects in that combination group due to a ceiling effect. And then finally, something that Zenshi pointed out to us already is that there is better glycemic control in the semaglutide group. And that the result of that may have actually been to reduced glucotoxicity. So that may actually be causing some of the differences that we see. And just as Zenshi pointed out, that may be why these groups are not really comparable at the point of exercise being introduced because of that preceding semaglutide in that intervention group. However, we'll go to the author's conclusions here, and I'll label them, first of all, as a summary that the authors give, and that is to quote, semaglutide treatment and physical training positively and synergistically improve beta cell secretory function in patients with sustained beta cell function. And then finally, and I will label this as an implication or implications from the authors, they suggest that, quote, this finding underscores the importance of early initiation of physical exercise after diagnosing type 2 diabetes and supports using semaglutide as a co-therapy to lifestyle intervention. Okay, so we're going to wrestle with these things as we wrap up. First of all, what I'd like us to do, as we typically do, just think about the quality of this report overall. We'll end here in a second with whether we should be changing our clinical practice. But before we get here, quality of the report overall. So, Steve, comments from you on your thoughts about how this study was done.
I think the study was done well, as well as you could given this format. Some of the results are somewhat unexpected, not in terms of the primary outcome, but in terms of some of the other outcomes. I think that one outcome, I guess we'll talk about practice in a second, so I'll leave that out. But I thought that this was well done. There were a lot of questions in my mind as to, for example, do obese type 2s and not obese type 2s behave the same way in this? I think it's a very restricted group of patients that were studied. And it certainly, and you'll get to practice later, it doesn't answer the question of if you had a little more beta cell function or a little less beta cell function and did the same study, would you get the same results?
Good. So as probably any good study does, it answers some questions, but to ask a whole lot more that we don't yet have the answers to. So, all right, Zenshi, thoughts from you, just a quality of this report overall.
Yeah, Chase, I overall agree with Steve that this is a well-done study. And given, you know, this study is actually very labor intensive. So I do want to congratulate the authors for, you know, carrying out this important study. Again, the only concern I have is to the interpretation probably needed to be softened a little bit. And because of the study design, again, makes it difficult to compare the two groups. So ideally, when you have to compare this effect, among you probably, when you talk about a synergistic or versus additive effect, you really have to have good controls in that case. So ideally, you would want to see a, you know, semaglutide alone for 32 weeks because, you know, clinical study showed semaglutide in 20 weeks actually, you know, does not reach its nadir in terms of weight loss or glycemic control. So it will continue. And probably a placebo group plus exercise. And then the group they studied, the combination group they studied.
Zenshi, do you think that had they done the order of operations in a different order, they would have gotten the same results?
You mean exercise first and add semaglutide? Probably I would be more, the data might be more convincing in terms of the additive effect.
Right. Or
alternatively, if they have one group of exercise through the entire course, plus the combination probably also is more convincing.
And we'll move into our final point here as thinking about changing practice. Should we do that? So this is very helpful. It's a clinical trial. So it starts to try to answer some questions that we ask a lot as we care for these patients. So Steve, I know you had some ongoing questions, but help us. What are the questions that you have that are remaining in your head that you would eventually like to get an answer to? But also give us some thoughts. Do you think this might change the recommendations and advice that you give to your patients with type 2 diabetes?
If this holds up in multiple studies, one of the negatives of using GLP-1 analogs is that when you lose weight, you lose lean body mass as well as fat mass. And I know that's not the primary endpoint of this paper, but in terms of practice, what I think the outstanding effect here is that exercise plus semaglutide prevented the lean body mass loss. And so that would suggest that if you get patients at this stage of their diabetes, if you're going to use a GLP-1 analog, it should be combined with exercise to prevent the lean body mass loss. I think that's a really important outcome from this, and that's certainly practice altering. I know that right now, GLP-1 analogs are very, very quote unquote hot for weight loss in the general population. And I think that consideration needs to be taken into account, that if someone's not going to exercise, they're going to lose lean body mass. It also affected the results within the study because there seemed to be less exercise ability, as it were, in the combined group than there was in the training group alone. And it, one of their hypotheses, and one of my hypotheses, is that the loss of lean body mass may have limited their ability to exercise if they lost muscle. So I think that that's a consideration. Certainly, if you sensitize the beta cell, that's important in terms of preserving beta cell function, because we know that with type 2 diabetes, the natural history of the disease is to lose beta cell function over time. So I think that's also important. And I'm still kind of questioning why they didn't see better outcomes in inflammatory markers, given that you had significant weight loss. And that's kind of running contrary to what have been seen in some other studies. I think in terms of the clinical implications, for me, those are the two biggest implications. The prevention of loss of lean body mass and the possible preservation of beta cell function.
Yeah, and also, Zinchi, as you give us your thoughts, I know you've done a lot of work in this space. So give us just some insight that you have on this work, how it connects with work that you've done, and then particularly as you put that together with this investigation and how that might then lead to change in our practice.
Yes, Chase, I actually agree completely with Steve on the necessity of a combination use of GLP-1 receptor agonist in the exercise training. Actually, I've been promoting among my patients, and for three reasons. And one is, just Steve mentioned, the potential loss of lean body mass, and you would have to initiate exercise training to prevent that. And secondly, both GLP-1 receptor agonist and exercise training have been shown to improve insulin sensitivity, reduce inflammation, which is probably the most important cause of insulin resistance and perhaps also beta cell death. And there's some good data showing that both of them are able to delay the onset of type 2 diabetes in high-risk patients. Additionally, several GLP-1 receptor agonists and exercise have beneficial cardiovascular actions. So it makes sense to use both of the interventions together. As I mentioned, we actually have done quite a bit of work, and we have human studies in type 2 diabetes and in people with metabolic syndrome ongoing. However, we did actually have done an interesting study in rodents. What we did was we fed rodents a high-fat diet and subjected those rodents to excess only, liraglutide only, and the combination of liraglutide and exercise. And interestingly, we found out that the combination, liraglutide and exercise, drastically improved insulin sensitivity in skeletal muscle and also in reducing vascular inflammation. So I think that might carry some clinical implications. And this study was published recently in July issue of Diabetes this year. So based on all those sort of evidence and from humans and in animals, I do believe that it make a good sense to use both of them in combination in people with type 2 diabetes or even in those at risk of type 2 diabetes.
Do you think that we can extrapolate twincretins and triagonists, et cetera, from these data? I think the studies just have to get done. I don't know that you can extrapolate it. What do you think, Senshi?
Well, it's hard to comment on that because a lot of studies are ongoing, particularly the triagonist data. The clinical trial is ongoing. And what encouraged me is actually in some of the studies, particularly with the new triagonist, it showed that probably there's more fat mass loss than lean body weight loss in those clinical trials. But again, those are in phase two trials and it's relatively small. So I'm looking forward to see the results from phase three trials at a much larger scale.
And with that, I would like to thank Steve Whitland and Zinchi Liu for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.